Okay, welcome. So this class is a very, very important class. And that is because, as we just said, two Jews, three opinions. The question is, how do you not allow another opinion to become an argument? So I remember, it's interesting, I've been living in Africa for 10 years. And, you know, from every culture, you could learn very interesting, good things from their culture. Just by way of interest, there's a book, it's called People Speak. And people send their, like, most important life story to this radio show host by the name of Chaim Walder in Israel. And they've translated the stories. It's fascinating, fascinating stories. This one story is of this kid who, unfortunately, his father passes away when he's 13. He says his father must have been too good for this world, and his stepfather was the exact opposite. And to make a long story short, unfortunately, he has to leave the house. And as a young kid, he's 15, he's like wandering, and he's very like spiritual kind of kid. And he ends up basically adopted by Bedouins. And he becomes part of the Bedouin society. And I think he came from a religious background, so he had a strong Jewish identity. And 12 years go by. Now, in the Bedouin society, a lot of people don't know this, but unfortunately there are a lot of Jewish girls that are trapped. They marry these Arab men, like Not In My Name. There's a lot of famous books, even by Westerners. So, you know, they look like studs, but really they're like little devils. And I think by them it's actually a mitzvah to try to get a Jewish girl. There's a lot that we don't know about their culture. I was just seeing that this Jew wrote, what was it? He says that I was brought up in Arab lands and I speak Arabic. And I heard them say that, one, like there are a lot of theories. Hey Ma, how are you? There are a lot of theories on how to deal with your enemies, because this is what they specialize in. So one of their things is, if you want to discredit your enemy, pay one of them to discredit them for you. So he says that's exactly what J Street is. Where does this guy have all this money all of a sudden to start putting out ads? And because they're paying him, the Arabs, and a lot of times they pay people, they pay Jews, because they're trying to... Anyway, so that's their specialty. So, unfortunately, there was a Jewish girl who married this Arab, and he said that he was a very abusive husband, and even the members of their own tribe were like against the amount of abuse. So he says, you can imagine the amount of abuse that's going on there. So, and he could never understand how a Jew would put up with that. It's like, and he says, then if in answer to his question, one day she and her older three children, she had like seven children, disappeared. And there's an organization in Israel, it's called Leman Achai, and they're really amazing people. They go in and they organize the Jewish girls that want to get out. They literally kidnap them, and they, they have safe houses. It's no joke.
Themselves at risk.
Yeah, definitely. No, they're real heroes, really genuine heroes. So this guy is in the camp, and the elders come to him and they say, you know, you're a Jew, we believe there's this organization that helps the people. Can you see about maybe getting her back? So again, now, one of the things that he said, which is very, very interesting, he says, you know, he always laughs when he reads people writing about how the Arab mentality. He says, a Westerner will never understand the Arab mentality. He says, in the West, there's black and white. Something's true or it's not true. He says, by the Arabs, there's a whole rainbow shade. And it could be like a truth is a kinder way of saying a lie is a kinder way of saying a truth. So it's a whole, it's like a different paradigm, it's a completely different world. And obviously a world which he was quite privy to because he was in it. So he didn't really want to do it, but he felt obligated because they like had adopted him. And off he goes to find the Manachai to see if he can get the woman back. And so he finds the Manachai and he sets up a meeting, you know, they set up a meeting. And he comes to them and he's got some kind of Baba Maisa that I've got some money that I want to give the woman. And the guy fished him out, 1, 2, 3. So he realized the guy knows exactly that he's... So he made an excuse to check out. So then the guy turns around and he says, let me tell you something. I know you're a Jew. And a Jew doesn't turn another Jew to the enemy. He really felt bad about the whole thing in the first place. So that penetrated, you know. And then he said to him, like, what's your story? You know, and so he now reversed himself and he started opening up, like, to the rabbi, telling him, you know, his whole story. One of the interesting things it says that Hashem makes marriages. And one of the very interesting things in this book is sometimes you see the most bizarre stories how God takes a people that they would never have met under normal circumstance and puts them together. So the guy's talking to him and he says to him, tell me, are you interested in getting married? So he says, yes. And then he tells him another problem he has. And that is that by now, he's got nothing in common with the girl from Tel Aviv. He's lived in a tent for 12, 13 years. And he actually likes some of the culture of the Bedouins. Doesn't know what to do, because the Bedouins would never take him, because for a man to marry a Jewish woman is okay, but the other way is not okay. So he doesn't know what to do. So he says, I have an idea. This lady, her daughter is Jewish. And she's a Bedouin. Why don't you marry the daughter? And he thought about it. He thinks, and he knew her from the tribe. He says, it's not a bad idea. So he didn't go back to the tribe. They got married. And he says, no, we don't live in a tent. We have an apartment in Tel Aviv. And that's the story. So the reason I said the story is that often, I forget the reason how I got into the story. It was an interesting story nonetheless. Who remembers why I began to say
that? Well, you said South Africa.
Right, South Africa. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Zevi.
Shalom Aleichem.
Shalom.
So, the point is that you can often learn things. So, I remember that one of the... intelligent black ladies, so that most of the black ladies there are basically maids, or they, what we would call cleaning ladies. And so whatever I was discussing with her, something, I didn't want her to feel bad, so I said, you know, I hope, you know, we're not arguing here. She says, no, we're discussing it. So in other words, the question is, how do you create, because the big challenge in life is, how do you not get into arguments? It's a very hard thing. Ironically, everybody wants to live peacefully, but how do you not get into arguments? So, to begin with, we have to understand a fundamental principle, and that is that the reason people do get into arguments, you don't find animals into arguments. Hey, you said that! You never find it. Never happened before. Why? Because the animal has no ego. You can't shame a dog. He doesn't feel any shame. So if that's the case, the reason we get, you know, in South Africa, there's a Yiddish word, I never heard the word before, but they're experts at this. It's called a faribel. They have the joke, a faribel. A faribel means like holding a grudge to the extent that you never speak to the guy because you're so upset at them. In fact, it says in the Mishnah that no Jew is really suspect of not speaking to another Jew for more than 3 days. So it's like not a Jewish thing. But anyway, it's the whole story. But the point of the matter is that there's a joke, they say, a Jew with Alzheimer's in South Africa is somebody who's forgotten everything but his valuables. He remembers who he's upset with. That's the way they are. Whatever cultural reasons, etc. It's very funny, but that's like very common there. So, but what does it really boil down to? It boils down to sensitivity. For whatever reason, certain cultures are stronger and certain cultures are more sensitive or more messed up. And therefore, they're easily offended and they're easily upset, etc., etc. So the interesting thing here is that when there's basically a seesaw model in life, and this is a very interesting thing, and it also additionally it's unique to humans, and as Dr. Twersky, quite a well-known psychiatrist and a bit of a philosopher, Hasidic rabbi, whatever, so he says about very interesting thing is that the only species that is dependent on their parents till they're 20 or so is the human. Most species, by the time they're 2, they're adults, fending for themselves. So humanity has a very big issue, and that's the issue of independence versus dependence. And on one hand, everybody wants to be independent, but on the other hand, everybody, to a certain extent, is at the very least interdependent. So we have issues. We're born with issues. And quite simply, there's a seesaw model, which is that when a child is a child, they feel dependent, and they are very much dependent on their parents. Therefore, they see themselves in a dependency fashion. And in fact, there's a famous psychologist who wrote a whole book on this concept. Then there's another model, which is same child, but he's with his friends. So there's no dependency. So he's a peer. So it's like, it's equal. And then, when that same child becomes an adult, and he has children, maybe a worker or something, somebody dependent on him, then he's the one on top. And in fact, it's a good thing. Because, as the Torah explains, why did Hashem create people with needs? Look at the animal world. Everybody's taken care of, you know. Every ant knows what it's got to do, and everybody's happy. But the thing is that Hashem wants us to unify. So you need a rabbi to teach you Torah. You need a dentist to make sure you don't get gingivitis or whatever it is. You need somebody to protect your house. You need somebody to help Jewish family, whatever. You know, everybody's got their mission in life. But the point is, why do we need to structure it like that? Why can't we have, like the animals, everybody does the same thing? Because there's no interaction otherwise. There's no interaction, there's no friendship. So the ultimate goal is to get to this stage, where we're basically on the same page as everyone else. But the fact is that you have a lot of people who usually, from childhood reasons, because in childhood we develop one of four basic ways of relating to people. The first is passive. Okay, you know, you have a lot of people, they're yes people. They go through life and they just do what everyone says because they, basically that's the attitude they develop. So funny, because even though we're all adults, we perceive ourselves still in the child spectrum and everybody else as an adult. So a lot of yes people. Then you have something called passive aggressive, which is yes, but don't make me too upset because I'll get you back in a way that you don't realize. A lot of those people. Then you have the healthy people, very few, called assertive, which means I'll stand up for myself, but not in an aggressive way, in a polite way. And then you have finally people who've basically suffer too much aggression, and they're basically aggressive. They're like angry people. They're attacking all the time. So, hey, how are you? So basically, those are the four kinds of ways that we relate to people. So obviously, the ideal would be if everybody's assertive, say, well, you know what, John, I'm really not interested in you giving me that shot. But most people wouldn't say that. They would be one of the other three. So if that's the case, in life you're always going to have to deal with, until Mashiach comes and heals everybody's heart, because it says when Mashiach comes, all the hearts will be healed. You're always going to have to deal with aggressive people. And I remember I was once speaking, and the psychologist was speaking, and she said that if somebody's aggressive to me, I right away think about, did I cause that aggression? And if the answer is no, it's someone else that caused that aggression. Because they're aggressive for a reason, but if it wasn't me, it was someone else. So most often, what happens is that the way somebody relates is based on their childhood experiences, and if that was negative, if there was too much negativity there, they become aggressive, unfortunately, and that's how they relate to everyone. So it doesn't make a difference what you do for them, their way of relating to people is aggressive. So the key thing here is, how do you not, you know, I met at my sister Dvaraleya, so they have a Chabad house in Williamsburg. It's really an amazing little store. It shows how Hashem runs everything. So for whatever reason, it was Purim night, and I decided to go there to just check in. And as this couple was leaving, I met them. Very interesting a couple, and we made up that I'd come to Manhattan and give a class in their house. So I went to Manhattan. And the guy was like, even though he had no real Jewish background, he had tremendous Jewish knowledge, incredible Jewish, you know, one of these souls that really just in tune. And one of the nice little stories he shared with me, and you can see this is the guy who practiced this, he said he once heard the story that a guy comes to, I think it was like a Buddhist monk or whatever they're called, and he comes in and he's angry and he wants to get things off his chest. So he just plows into him. You're a da-da. So the guy smiles. He says, thank you very much. Thank you. And I want to bless you, etc., etc. So then later, somebody came over. He says, how was it possible that you were so positive when that guy was so negative? He says, let me show you how. So he takes some dirt from the earth. And he says, I'd like to give this to you. Do you want it? She says, no, what do I want mud for? What do I want dirt for? He says, I didn't take the dirt that he was giving. So the thing is, in life, it's not usually that simple. Because the fact is that most people, at least if you're brought up in a good way, you're not aggressive. So you're passive, in a sense. You're open. And therefore, the openness that you have is you're like receptive. And therefore, ironically, it's like, I mean, you see it so clearly in Israel, where the enemies of Israel have no compassion. They're murderers. They're the worst people that exist. Yeah, exactly. And yet, the Israelis have such a hard time understanding that. They don't understand who the enemy is. And the reason for that is because they're good. So they're not able to actually understand where the other person is. Oh, it must be some land. Okay, we'll give them land. But it's, they just can't conceptualize the type of person that's there. I mean, nobody could think that the Germans would do what they did. It just wasn't conceivable to the Jew. Now, ironically, one Arab knows the other Arab. So they're busy, you know, protecting themselves from each other because they know each other. You know, in fact, when the Jews won in 1967, they were sure that they'd be slaughtered. It wasn't even a question. Why? Because you think that somebody else is going to behave like you. But, of course, the Jews are like, yeah, stay, etc., etc. So, in other words, the question is, what do you do when somebody is negative? And the answer is very, very important. The reason it's so important is because it seems to me that basically all of life is about a very simple but very challenging idea, and that is simply that we should always be in the state of love. So last week we discussed some of the ways how to get out of fear. But one of the greatest ways of not being in the state of love is being resentful of unjust criticism. So the person who's aggressive uses criticism as that's just how they deal with the world. They're walking around and that's how they deal with the world. So the question is, how do you, in a sense, not take that dirt which is being thrown at you? How do you not take it? And the reason it's so important is, I remember, because South Africans are so, unfortunately, they're sensitive and et cetera, so there was this psychologist, he was giving a speech once, quite a famous psychologist in South Africa. So it wasn't really my question, but I asked it for the sake of the audience. I said to him, what's like the chemical process of having a parable? Like, okay, so you have a grudge. So he says, that's like taking poison and waiting for the other person to die. Which is, it's a well-known concept. But it's quite a true thing. And I'm not going to go into there, I don't know how much time we have, but I go through some of the actual problems of where you see where resentment actually, the issues. But what I'm going to go to is, I'm going to go pretty much straight to the end. I really recommend you read through it, because there are a lot of interesting stories, very profound concepts. But basically the key thing is that resentment is very, very, very dangerous to you, the other person. In fact, maybe it makes them feel a bit better about themselves, which is usually why people who are aggressive are doing that, because somebody put them down, and now they're trying to pick themselves up. So the two ways that you can pick yourself up. One way is that you can jump high. The other way is push someone else down. And most times, people who are aggressive are trying to do the easier way, which is instead of picking yourself up and working on yourself and getting rid of your negative emotions, etc., etc., the easier way is just make someone else feel bad, and that automatically picks you up. Which, as we go into, is really, in a sense, the basis of anti-Semitism. It doesn't happen from people who are healthy and happy. It happens from people who, like Hitler, are put down or, have bad parents, people who basically are bad to them, and they return the favor to others. There are other causes as well, which we mentioned was quite interesting. But let's focus more on what the solution is. So I've taken out of Judaism and Jewish mysticism five practical solutions. And the first one comes from Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. And the Code of Jewish Law says quite clearly that the highest thing that you can do is to forgive someone. So the one thing that's definitely a no-no is to hold hatred in your heart. In fact, as the Baal Shem Tov says, he says every positive mitzvah in the Torah, so there are 248 do mitzvahs, the 365 don't do. So he says every do mitzvah has a corresponding don't do mitzvah. So what's the corresponding don't do mitzvah to love your friend as much as yourself, which is the most important mitzvah in the Torah? It is don't hold hatred in your heart, which is easier said than done, especially to exes. So the question is, how do you not hold hatred in your heart? And the Shulchan Aruch says clearly, forgive the person. So soon we'll discuss maybe more practical techniques on how to do it, but we're going to go through the theories before we get through the practice. The next one, and it's very, very interesting that the Shulchan Aruch, Jewish law, brings us down. I mean, the highest ethical code in the universe is bringing this down. And it says that if you can't forgive them, you should confront them. And you should tell them, I'm upset that you did such and such to me. So it's a very interesting concept, because in other words, what the Torah is telling us, don't hold hatred in your heart. That is a bigger issue than confronting the person and saying to the person, look, And again, you're not taking revenge. You are quite simply stating, I am upset with you that you did X, Y, Z in an assertive, not an aggressive manner. The next way is a very interesting way, which is brought down in the Tanya. And the Tanya speaks about a very interesting thing. There's a story that Label Wolf shares, which maybe sums it up best. And the story is as follows. That a guy gets onto a train and he brings 5 little kids with him. And there's another man, you know, it's an English train and he's reading the newspaper to see if Cameroon is in or out or whatever the story is. And these kids are running amok. They're running up and down the train. It's not good. It's disturbing his English tea and his whole structure of life that he's created for himself. Very, very difficult. I'll never forget when I went to yeshiva in England. So we had to go, you had to register for something. So we're like in the queue, which was funny as it is. And so we're like 5 guys. And all of a sudden, like the 5, you know, these are government officials, but you're like 50 people, they disappear. You know, in America, you'll never see that. You know, imagine like you go to passport control, the people, they just get up and they disappear. What happened to the people? It's tea time. That's it. It's tea time. The whole world can go. It doesn't make a difference. It's tea time. Tea time, right? So it reminds me of a friend of mine. I've never seen it, but they say it's pretty funny, Monty Python. So he's, I guess he's some kind of sergeant, and he, I don't know, fighting a war somewhere, wherever they're, I think he was fighting a Boer war in South Africa. They have bombs going off, this and that, and you know, something like, say, the doctor comes in, he says, well, we're very sorry, your foot is gangrene, and he's busy with his tea and his newspaper, he says, oh, and the doctor says, well, we're going to have to cut it off. He says, oh, well then, just go ahead and do it. And he goes back to his newspaper. So it's a very, like, cold mentality. In fact, Rebbe, who understood mentalities very, very well, said about the, in a sense, the goal of Chabad in England was to melt the iceberg, just to bring some warmth to the climate there. So, how do we get into this?
We're on the bus. I know the story.
Right. Yeah, right, yeah, right. So, thank you.
The guy's sitting there and he's reading his newspaper.
Right.
And the kids are running
amok. And the kids are running amok. Thank you. So, what happens is that the kids are disturbing this guy. So, in a typical English fashion, he looks up at the father and he says, sorry, sir, can't you control your children? And the guy says, you know, you're right, I really should, but unfortunately it was the mother's funeral this morning and I'm in a bit of a daze. So all of a sudden the guy feels really bad for these kids. So what does he do? He goes and he starts taking care of them and he starts showing them whatever pictures, etc., etc. So what changed? Why, one second, was he ready to clobber the kids and the father, and the next second, he's helping them? So, in fact, although we say there are 2 emotions, which in a sense there are actually 3. And the third emotion is a very, very powerful, very, very important emotion. And the first 2 emotions, as we say, is love and fear. But the third emotion is a very, very powerful emotion, and that's the emotion of compassion, emotion of mercy. And the reason that emotion is so powerful is because let's say you have love for somebody, it doesn't mean that that person can't make you afraid, right? So if that person makes you afraid, your love will turn to hatred. On the other hand, if you have compassion, you'll kill the hatred and you'll just have love. Amazing, amazing emotion that God gave us. Emotion that you don't find in the animal world. The emotion of compassion is a uniquely human-induced emotion. And that's one of the great gifts that God has given us, And that is through using our minds, we're able to eliminate fear and its offshoot anger and induce compassion, and then you won't be holding a grudge. One of these stories in this People Speak was of this girl who, it seems like there were two bullies in her class, they're really making her life miserable. Anyway, so she prays to God, and one of them, I guess, like gets transferred out of the school, and the other one is like, you know, really just harassing. And she says to her, well, don't you think, you know, like, aren't you afraid of God? Look what happened to the other one. So she says, oh, so now she like triples the harassment. Anyway, she feels she has no choice, so she prays to God again. And something really bad happened, like really terrible happened to the boy. So it was actually something, I think, in the family. I'm not sure what it was. And then, it's quite amazing, because she says, so amazingly, like even though this bad thing happened, the bully comes back, but continues being a bully, but yet it had no more effect on her, because now she felt compassionate for the bully. So it's such an amazing thing that the circumstances don't have to change, but your compassion that you have in your heart can change, and that compassion will eliminate all anger. It's an amazing tool. So how can we feel compassionate to somebody who, let's say, is harassing us? And the answer is that you can feel compassion on the low spiritual state that the person is in. So somebody who, let's say, is that evil, obviously their spiritual standing is at the depths. You know, it's they're literally at least spiritually speaking, probably from all standpoints, they're really not in a good place. And one of the big mistakes that we often make is we think that, like, you know, instead of, I always say, like, look who's talking when the Arabs are condemning the Jews of human rights. But sometimes we fail to think that. We look at what the person is saying, we forget who's talking. So when it comes to this kind of thing of when somebody is condemning you, the very first question is, look who's talking. And 99.9% of the time, that's enough to answer the question. And the thing is, if we can then feel compassion on where this person is, you know, on the spiritual, and the way the Tanya speaks about it, I think it's a bit hard to do, but the Tanya mentions that basically, in a sense, God is imprisoned in this person, because everything really, its life is God. But when we do mitzvahs, then God is happy. So, but if we, God forbid, do something hurtful, then although God gives you life, but it's like imprisoning him, it's like, you know, putting his face in the dirt, you're hurting him. So in a sense, you can feel compassion, this is what the Tanya speaks about in the 32nd chapter, feel compassion for God that is imprisoned and is being hurt within him. And that compassion will eliminate the anger. So that's three. And four is, that's four. Right. The force, it's also mentioned in the Tanya. In fact, it mentions this first in the Tanya before it mentions the thing in chapter 32. And it seems that this is a much more, just need to check something, sorry. It seems that this is much more of a standard way, as opposed to the way that I said about compassion. And that is quite simply, the Tanya brings down from the Zohar, that the Zohar says if you want to learn how to not have a faribul, you should take the ultimate guy who was, who do you think in the Torah was most entitled to have a grudge from all the characters in the Torah? Who do you think was most entitled?
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Yoav? In the
Abraham.
Five books of Moses.
Abraham?
Good question. Good point, Yoav, but we're going to the five books. Not Abraham.
Esau?
Not Esau, no. Esau had no right. Abraham, maybe, but Esau definitely not.
Job?
No. Joseph. Joseph was sold by his own brothers for doing what his father, their father, had asked him to do. The man was first put into pit, then he was sold into slavery, was then put into prison, and none of this he had deserved. And yet, what do we find practically? He actually saves his brothers, he brings them, and he gives them, he feeds and he clothes them. So the Zohar uses the words ligmo lechayovim toivim, to give those who deserve punishment goodness. In fact, it's an interesting thing. The Baal Shem Tov says that feed your enemy, it's the best revenge. But be that as it may, the concept from the Zohar, this is my own interpretation, that how did Joseph have that equanimity? I mean, it's quite an amazing thing. If my brother sold me, I'd be a bit upset. The reason he has, quite simply, is when the brothers come and they say, our father said that you should treat us nicely, he says, it wasn't you. Or maybe it was actually earlier in the story. He says, it was Hashem. Hashem did this in order for me to save the world. So in other words, if you can truly believe that things come from God, then you won't get angry. And this is something that the Alter Rebbe brings later, I think it's in the fourth book of the Tanya. But he brings this point, very interesting point, and that is that if you believe in destiny, you won't get angry. And he says as follows. Let's say a guy comes and the guy punches you in the face. He says, the fact that he punched you in the face, God's going to punish him. But the fact that you got punched in the face, that comes from God. So on one hand, everybody has freedom of choice. On the other hand, what happens to you is destiny. Your freedom of choice is not what happens to you, but rather the choices of good and bad that you make. That's the only freedom of choice we have in life. And of course, there are consequences of those choices. But the only freedom of choice, I mean, none of us decided how we'd look. None of us decided our metabolism. Some people, they can eat all day and they're skinny. Is that fair? I ask you. So the point is that destiny, and who knows, maybe in a previous lifetime I did something and I had to be punched in the face in this lifetime. And we spoke about this a little bit before, you know, how the Sephardim, they have this mentality, and how I believe in India also, where they have the mentality of karma, they just don't get upset. In the West, we don't have this mentality. We believe very strongly in right and wrong, and if you go against the judgment, we get angry. But actually, it pays to mention the story. I wrote it here, but it's really a remarkable story. Anybody see the movie Ushpizin? Saw it? Yeah? Yeah, a great movie, huh? Very profound. So I believe that the Ushpizin story is based on the true story, which happened as follows. The Rebbe actually mentions the story, so when a Rebbe mentions the story, there's a lot to learn from it. So there's a guy by the name of David, simple Jewish peasant, you can say, comes into the Baal Shem Tov's table. And the Baal Shem Tov was in a bit of a serious mood. Like Chassidim, you always try to be happy, and his great disciples, all great tzaddikim in their own right, they couldn't get the Baal Shem Tov happy. But when David comes in, Baal Shem Tov beams with joy. And of course he sensed their perplexion, why should David make the Baal Shem Tov so happy? And they, the disciples, the tzaddikim, who know all the tricks of the trade, they couldn't make him happy. There's something really special happened here. So what happened was, the Baal Shem Tov wanted to answer, so he asked David to maybe go get some, I don't know, mashka or something. He sent him on an errand. He said as follows. He says, David is a man who ekes out a living. It's very, very difficult for him. And yet he never complained. In fact, there was a story that the Tzemach Tzedek, who was the leader of Russian Jewry, millions of Hasidim, and his seven sons who were tzaddikim, and they all became rebbes, or I think six of them became rebbes after that. So there was once a story that he showed strong interest in someone. And one of his sons said, why do you show such strong interest in him? So he said that this is a person, I think he lost two wives, and he had a lot of children. Very, very hard life, but he never complains. And he says, and that's a very great, great trait. Somebody's able to be content despite difficulties. Anyway, so that shows us a great trait. But the story gets better. Story is that one year David goes to the marketplace, and for the first time in his life he wanted to be wealthy. Why? It wasn't for the latest Porsche or the iPad or 4G phone. It was because there's a special mitzvah to have a beautiful esrog. Now, in the olden days, you know, people didn't have such access to goods and services like we have today. So all the poor people gave a coin into the town, whatever, treasury, and they bought one lulav and esrog. They would all share this, and by the time it got to the David, the thing was brown and was half dead. So he wanted to have a beautiful esrog. And the wealthy people, they're able to buy a beautiful esrog. Looks nice, the whole thing. So he decided, come what may, next year he's going to buy his own esrog. And he put away penny after penny. And the thing is, his situation wasn't any better. So it was harder. And his wife, Nebuch, she had to look at the children, that they couldn't get new clothing. You know, it's not like when you were poor in the olden days, you really were poor. It's not like today where the basics are there at least. And so, to make a long story short, David finally goes with his purse filled with 1 cent coins. He goes to the marketplace and he goes to the stand where they're selling the nicest regim, and he says, I'd like your nicest esrog. Nicest esrog? The guy looks at him and he looks at the pauper with tattered clothing and he says, here we serve the rich, not the poor. So he doesn't say anything and he takes out his little purse and he empties all his 1 cent coins. So the guy understood what went on, and he took the most beautiful esrog that he had, something that was worth far more, but he understood what this guy had sacrificed. And he gave him this, in the movies, the yalum, the diamond esrog, the best esrog. And the man's ecstatic. He finally is going to make a bracha, and fulfill God's will. He's in seventh heaven. He couldn't be happier. And he comes home, his wife sees him all happy, and she says, David, what are you so happy about? So he breaks his silence. You know, he wasn't an idiot. He hadn't told his wife about what he was going to do. And he says, you know, I saved up the whole year. I've got the esrog. She sees the esrog. She wasn't a bad woman, but she realized what happened. Here they could have had money to buy the kids some shoes, some extra food. So she says to him, what, the average esrog wasn't good enough? She starts to cry, and she thinks about her fate, how miserable her husband is, what a schmo he spends the family money on the esrog. She gets more and more bitter until she takes the pitim, which is the top part, she breaks it off, no more esrog. So, of course, the question is, how would you react? And the example that I give, you know, to bring it into current day times, imagine you actually saved your whole life and you just got a Lamborghini. And your wife is all upset with you and she drives it and there's no oil and she ignores it. Boom, the engine shock. How would you react? So David says as follows. He says, you know, it's enough that I don't have an esrog. Should I also sin by getting angry? Or another version that he said, that it seems that a simple person like me needs to use the community esrog. So in other words, He refused to get angry. And the Baal Shem Tov was very happy. He said, since the time that Hashem asked Avraham Avinu to sacrifice his son, nobody was given such a personal challenge that was so difficult. And he passed the test. So, in other words, by really believing, I think that's something that we have difficulty doing, but something that Yosef did, something that David did, by truly believing in destiny, what are you going to be angry about? It's when we forget that things come from God, and something can be truly unjust, but it doesn't mean that Hashem doesn't have a better reason for why it's happening. It could be a soul reason. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a negative. Then, finally, there's another very interesting concept. And this is a very, very important concept to know. So until now, we've spoken about more like somebody personally insults you, how to not to take that, how not to get upset. And we discussed like four methods. But there's another interesting concept, and that is that when you, you know, certainly experienced this in, you know, as a community rabbi, etc., etc., when you're doing good, one of the best signs that you're doing good is that you're being criticized. Well, if all you're doing is being criticized, maybe you need to step back. But if you're getting 90% praise and 10% criticism, that's a good sign. It's not a bad sign. And the reason for that is that, ironically, the instinct for bad, a story tells it best. There was a great chassid, probably a tzaddik as well, by the name of Shmuel Munkus. Now, Shmuel Munkus was a famous jester, but apart from his jesting, he was a very, very holy man. In fact, it says that when he would go to a field to meditate, that field would start to grow beautifully. So, Shmuel Munkus, a cute story, is everybody know what Yizkor is? You say the prayer, so all the people who have parents go out, right? So once the Alter Rebbe, who was Shmuel Munkus' Rebbe, wasn't in town, and a lady came for a blessing. She had very difficult childbirth, so she wanted a blessing. So he said, you should say Yizkor 7 times when you go into labor. So it's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. I mean, I've never heard of any rabbi said to a woman, say Yizkor 7 times. And then she comes back, maybe a year later, she's got her kid, and she comes to Alter Rebbe, she says, thank you so much. I said Yizkor 7 times, and it worked. So the Alter Rebbe realized right away. So he calls in Shmuel Munkus, he says, what were you thinking? Why didn't you say Yizkor 7? He says, look, you say Yizkor once, all the children leave shul 7 times. So Shmuel Munkus was once at a farbrengen. And a farbrengen, you have food, etc. And they brought in from the butcher's house, I forget what it was, but it was a very delicious aroma, it was great meat, and of course they weren't wealthy in those days, so it was probably special as well. Shmuel Munkus takes it, and he starts dancing with the meat. And, okay, cute joke. Finally they say, serve the meat. He ignores them. After a while, they're like ready to like forcibly take it from him, you know? Takes the whole thing, and he dumps it in the toilet. So, you know, it's a veira, it says baltashkes, you're not allowed to. So they're thinking, what do we do to Shmuel Munkus? Anyway, make a long story short, they like pretend to like potch him, and they continue with the farbrengen. All of a sudden the butcher runs and he says, that meat, it's treif, don't eat the meat. Now, Hasidim are humble people, so they thought, Shmuel Munkus, he's showing off that he has divine prophecy. Now he really deserves a punishment. So they say, what's the deal, Shmuel Munkus? What, you're trying to brag? Many of these people were very, very spiritual people. Very, you know, they probably, many of them had these abilities. So he says, no, I don't have any Ruach HaKodesh. There are various levels of prophecy. One of the lower levels called Ruach HaKodesh, where it's not prophecy, but it is just communication. So he says, no, I don't have any Ruach HaKodesh. It's just that the Alter Rebbe taught me, he says, that the desire for negative is stronger than the desire for positive. He says, when that piece of meat came in, I suddenly felt a very strong desire to eat it. So I realized that that must come from the Yetzer Hara. And therefore, I threw it out. I mean, these were people of the stature. They were able to judge all their emotions. They really understood the whole world. And in such a sense, for example, there's a famous story of Yonis and Eibschitz, great tzaddik, that there was once, I think, a Catholic priest who decided to like sit in and learn Torah from him. Only one problem is innocent Eibschitz, he said to him, you're not a Jew. They said, how did you know he wasn't a Jew? He knew Gemara, a lot of these people were very fluent. So he says, he didn't chuckle when he learned. These people, the little nuances, they were very deep, they were able to understand. So the point that I'm saying here is that it's a very, very interesting point, and that is that, for example, I did a radio show in South Africa. So I was waiting for the criticism, because I knew that as soon as I'd start getting criticism, I'm making an impact. I'm rocking the boat. If you don't get criticism and you're doing good, you're not doing good. You're literally not. That's why, for example, Chabad is so criticized, because they're rocking the boat. They're changing the whole parameter. They're going out and they're saying, no, you could have a nice long beard in Kansas City. That rocks the boat. So by now, a lot of Jews have been comfortable, but when you know, I'm sure when you first came out, you had some criticism. I remember my bubby. They emigrated to Cleveland. So an hour after they had come, they had like escaped Stalinist Russia. A Jew comes to them, you know, part of the Federation who had brought them down, you know. He grabs my grandfather by the beard, a fanatic in Cleveland! So in other words, you're rocking the boat. So of course, most good people are respectful. But if Israel wasn't criticized, it's because Israel had become the enemy. And therefore, we have to understand. And this is the real truth. The real truth is that everything is a message from Hashem. So you can ask yourself the question, why, if I'm doing good, is Hashem giving me a message? Should be patting me on the back. The money should be falling from the sky, man. I'm doing good.
The oil should be pumping from the ground.
Right. Okay. Oil should be pumping from the ground.
There's
a famous... Pardon?
Not a middle story.
There's a famous story that a tzaddik who used to go around collecting for people, because some people were too ashamed to go collecting. Many of these tzaddikim would do that. So one guy had asked him if he needed something. His daughter has got a leg that's broken. He needs a whole story. So he goes around to the town. He comes back. An hour later, he gives him the money. He says, look, I'm going to give you the money. But is it really true that your daughter broke the leg? He says, no, but how did you know? He says, every time I go fundraising, everybody's got a reason why they shouldn't give. This time, everybody was ready to give. And this is... sounds real, Scott?
So, I have to remember that one.
So the point is that when you're doing good, that is when Hashem is challenging you. Now the question is why? Why is Hashem challenging? Because remember, before we said that the desire for good isn't as strong as the desire for bad. So what Hashem is challenging you is to double your effort. And if you will double your conviction and your effort, the problem will dissipate. I actually saw this where a man came to the Rebbe, and you can see he was very dignified, you know, probably wealthy, good Jewish philanthropist. And he comes to the Rebbe during dollars. The Rebbe would give every Sunday to thousands of people. Everybody's welcome to come. He'd give them a blessing and a dollar, which is spiritual Anyway, to make a long story short, he tells Rebbe he's working on some kind of non-profit thing they're building in Jerusalem. He says it's like really hard. You can tell as a man who's a successful man, he knows what he's doing. He's saying it's like coming up with a lot of obstacles. So the Rebbe says to him clearly, you know, it's like with a smile, he says, Hashem wants you to double your efforts. In other words, Hashem is trying to squeeze out the best of us. And I'll never forget a man, I overheard this, there's a very bright rabbi in South Africa, quite a knowledgeable guy. It just happened, it's amazing how Hashem puts you in the right place in the right time. I just overheard, guy says to him, why did God make the gullus, the exile, so hard for the Jews? So he right away replied, he says, when you want oil from an olive, you have to squeeze it. But the point is, God, if you need to go somewhere, you're welcome to go because we're over. Yeah. The point is that God is not looking to squeeze us. God is looking for the oil. And therefore, if we produce the oil, if we double our efforts, the negative will actually dissipate. It will disappear.
So is that why Golden Meyer says God wasn't so great to see? Brought us, of all places, he brought us the only place in the Middle East without oil.
Well, they just discovered gas off Haifa, so that's a compensation price. Yeah. So, I think there's a book written, Moses, No Oil. What were you thinking? But it's actually interesting what you're saying, because that actually brings out the point very nicely. One of the things it says in the Torah, the difference between Israel and the land of Egypt, is that Israel is a land that doesn't have the Nile. Now, the Nile is what made Egypt so prosperous, because it was an irrigation system second to none. It flooded every, predictably, it flooded even today. You go there thousands of years ago, they've got these graphs within the Nile of when it's going to come up, etc. They just created, I forget what you call them, the little like streams that went off it. And that's what made them so prosperous, because they didn't have to worry about drought. It just flooded, it was on schedule, they had an irrigation system. Which for an ancient culture, in fact they say the reason they're the Mayan temples, etc., is because under that whole thing is a tremendous amount of water. It's very, so therefore once you have the economy going, hey, you can make yourself crazy with other mishigasi. But the thing is that Israel has a water shortage. And it says Israel is a place where it depends on your behavior. If you're davening to Hashem, and if you're good, the water comes down. If not, you get a drought. So in other words, Hashem, with love, treats us in a way that's different. Because, you know, I think it's, God who, Rebbetzin, is that famous Rebbetzin who always, pardon?
Jungreis.
Yeah, Rebbetzin Jungreis. So she says this concept, I think it's a famous Jewish concept, that Hashem cursed the snake, your dust, that dust will be its food. So the question is, what kind, I mean, dust is quite plentiful. Why is that a curse? And the answer is that when something comes without any effort, it's not actually a great blessing. It's a curse. And that's why we're finding that people that are on welfare, they're not happy people. They're actually, you know, like there are a lot of, let's say, minorities, they're like complaining. This, I know, like I'm coming from Africa. If these people, relative to their brothers in Africa, they're millionaires. So what are you complaining about? But the thing is that at least, let's say, you know, I don't know, my maid or my gardener, they're working for their money. And therefore there's that sense of satisfaction that I earned it. So in other words, when a person is truly loved, they're not given things, they have to earn it. And the earning process, the difficulty process, is a process that makes the reward valuable. So just to conclude, I have a few exercises here, a bit more than the other ones. So exercise 4, try to think of all the people who have insulted you. If need be, write them down and write, I forgive these people. Don't forget to include yourself. Bonus, something bad has occurred to you, write down as many positive benefits that you can conjure up that have come from it. Big bonus. Instead of feeling anger and resentment, try to feel compassion for the low spiritual state a person who is denigrating or harming you must be in. Big, big bonus. Every night before going to bed, do the first exercise. And that's actually brought down in the Siddur that you're meant to forgive everyone every night. Just a cute little anecdote. One year, I'm not sure what got into my head, but it was worth it for the story. I called my grandfather, I'm quite close to, before Yom Kippur, and I said to him, you know, it's a tradition, you ask everyone for forgiveness. So he said, first of all, you didn't do anything wrong, but second of all, and this was a very interesting thing, he says, Chassidim forgive everyone every night. That was quite interesting, because that meant that even if I had, he had already forgiven me that night. So it's quite a good idea on a nightly basis. Big, big, big bonus. Every night before going to bed, ask yourself, what acts of kindness and growth have I achieved today? And that's a very important thing in general. I'm not going to go into it, but it's an exceptionally important thing to do. And the biggest bonus is when bad people make fun of you, even if they come up with convincing arguments, you should not only ignore it, but see it as a message from God to continue your efforts to the point that it doesn't even bother you.
What efforts? Efforts to ignore them, efforts to forgive them?
Right, good question. So we're referring here to, let's say you're doing something for the community, and then somebody says something wrong. So the first four things were the interpersonal. So somebody, it has nothing to do with community. But the fifth thing is a very important thing, and that's whenever you are doing something for the public, then you know you're doing something altruistically, you should understand that that is a message from Hashem. And what is it that Hashem wants? He wants you to double your efforts. And if you do so, and I've seen this, it's quite amazing, if you do so, you won't have any more issues. And the trap that people often get into, and particularly as Jews, the trap that we've often gotten into, and the great rabbis have not fallen into the trap, but the trap is like, you respond to anti-Semitism. That's not the answer. The answer is to increase the Judaism. And that is the answer. Any questions? Pardon? Well, I mean, if, let's say, the Arabs are saying, you know, you stole the land. So, the worst thing that you can do is answer that question. As it says, Al tang sil ki valte pentishvile, don't answer a fool in his foolishness, lest you become like him. So the best thing that you can do, I remember seeing again Ariel Sharon, who the Rebbe tried to, and I'm sure he helped him in many different things. In fact, the way the Yom Kippur War was won was the Rebbe, in a sense, gave him permission and the moral courage to go into Egypt against orders, which he did, and he won the war. And then they wanted to court-martial him, but the Israeli public felt that it wouldn't be the right thing to do. But to make a long story short, so, I mean, essentially he was right-wing, but the reason he did what he did was because of the pressure that America had put on him. So once he came by the Rebbe, and he said, whatever, he'd like a blessing that there's, whatever, because America's putting pressure. So the Rebbe said to him, the Jews in Israel should strengthen their Torah and mitzvahs. It's very interesting because you see, like, what is he talking about? Like Ariel Sharon, he's like looking at him like, what are you talking about? And Rabbi Label Groner, the Rebbe's assistant secretary, he says to him, the Rebbe is saying that the Jews in Israel should strengthen the Torah and mitzvahs in answer to your question. So the point is that we have to understand that we as Jews, saw a very interesting thing today. There's a very wealthy Jew who owns insurance companies, so he has a yacht, and the Rebbe brought him back to Judaism. He was a Holocaust survivor, so he was davening on his yacht. So you daven, you face where? You face east, right? So every third of the day, he comes to the captain, and he says to the captain, where, you know, what's the direction of east? And the captain's thinking, what does he need to know where east is? I need to know where east is. So he asked him, what's the story? So the captain says, you know, so he says, captain, excuse me, I'm a religious Jew and I pray to the Creator. Captain gets very inspired and he says, if this guy who owns a yacht is praying to the Creator, I should, what a great world it would be. And he starts telling everybody about praying to the Creator. So the Rebbe liked this concept very much, but what I want to emphasize, a very interesting point, is that Rebbe says in the end there that people think, let's say the captain is driving the ship, but who's really in charge of that ship? Where's the real direction coming from?
The compass.
Pardon?
The compass.
Not the compass. Pardon?
The Eberstein.
No?
No?
Well, not in the, I mean, in the sense, the Eberstein, but in the example. The owner. The owner is saying, I want to go to Israel. And so the captain's driving the ship, but who's really driving it? It's the owner. Rebbe says the same thing as in the world. Presidents are, let's say, in charge of countries. I actually saw this. This guy was more of a religious guy. He came by the Rebbe, also in the Israeli government, also the same issue. Rebbe said, it says, it's a very famous verse, it says the heart of presidents is in God's hands. So, you know, there's a famous story of a guy, I think I mentioned it, but a guy who becomes a king, and he was friendly to the Jews, all of a sudden he started becoming an anti-Semite. And one of his buddies, a Jewish kid who grew up with him, comes to him, he says, Ivan, what's going on here, you know? So he says, I don't know what to tell you, since I became a king, I've got this thing that I have to oppress the Jews. So in other words, the heart of the non-Jews is completely in God's hands. Whether they oppress us or whether they don't, they have no freedom of choice in that. So, in other words, I remember this rabbi when I was in Plett, quite an interesting, colorful character. He just said, matter-of-factly, he says, you know, terrorism is a symptom. Very interesting quote. Terrorism is a symptom. If Jews were to dedicate themselves fully, I mean, we're not, God forbid, condemning anyone. We're just saying that spiritually speaking, the way it works is, and you look through the history of Tanakh, prophets, whenever the Jews were dedicated to Hashem, there were no issues. Whenever they went to idols or were left to Hashem, there were big issues. So when the Rebbe is telling Ariel Sharon the Jews should strengthen their Torah and mitzvahs, that's not something else. That's directly related to what's going to happen in Israel. Because the Jewish people, that's what the Rebbe is saying, are the real owners of the world. Not to sound racist, but it says clearly that there are two primary reasons God created the world. One is for the Jewish people, the other is for Torah. So in other words, if you are the primary reason of the world, then you have the ability to shape its destiny. I heard this story, I'm not sure if it's 100% correct. Okay, take care. That, take care. Okay, so the story is that that Geula Cohn, she's a minister in, or she's a parliamentary member in Israel, so she came once and she heard the Rebbe speaking, and the Rebbe was speaking all about Israel, not giving away land, etc., etc. So then later the Rebbe asked to find out, you know, what she thought of what he said. So different versions of what she said, but one of them, no matter what, it sounds interesting. One of the versions is as follows, that she says, all very nice, and she agrees with the Rebbe, but she doesn't understand what speaking to a few hundred Hasidic rabbis in Brooklyn is going to make a difference to Israel. So the Rebbe said that when the Hasidim in Crown Heights have Machshava Zaris, when they're not basically on their highest level, they give away shtachim in Israel, they give away land in Israel. So in other words, it is interconnected. What the Jews do, not necessarily in a negative, but in a positive way, we have through increasing goodness, increasing Torah mitzvahs, increasing, we have the ability to actually change reality. That's, if anything, the Rebbe stood for this message, that Mashiach will come through our additions of mitzvahs dedicated for the coming of the Mashiach. Answer your question?